Hey there, and welcome to the Smart and Simple Matters show with your host, Joel Zeslovsky. Have you ever interacted with a child? You have? Good news! I have something powerful to share with you right now. This is episode number 79. Hello, everybody. So glad to see you. Hello, everybody. I'm so glad to see you. Hello to Emily. I love your review. I'll read it to everybody because I'm grateful for you. That was my attempt to be childlike and creative, with the childlike part being much easier for me to pull off, as always. If you've ever gone through the Music Together program with your kid or listened to a young child channel on Pandora Radio, you may recognize that tune as the Hello song. It's a crowd pleaser. Now, it's rather appropriate because this episode is all about kids. Your kids, my kids, your friends' kids, your grandkids' kids. By the way, the reference to Emily a moment ago was for Emily McDermott of simplyemmy.blogspot.com. She recently left me a wonderful iTunes review with a subject of "Joel is the best companion for my commute," and here's what she wrote. "I've recently been introduced to the amazing world of minimalism, simplicity, living intentionally, and making decisions in my life based upon the value it brings to myself and to others. Joel has a great conversational style, asks insightful questions, and is always concerned about bringing value to the listeners. This is a refreshing approach and keeps me coming back for more. In addition, the show notes are extremely well organized and contain the essentials of what he discusses in the show without any fluff." End of review. Emily, maybe shall I call you Emmy? At any rate, thanks for the review, and I'm glad you like my version of what I call comprehensive simplicity. Not everybody appreciates my thoroughness and organizing style, but I'm glad you do. I've been feeling the love from a different crew, from the Patreon crew as well, and I invite you to check it out and even consider supporting me and this show over there too at valueofsimple.com/Patreon. Most importantly, I just want you to focus on this episode because it's a good, good one. I caught up with Kim John Payne, best known for his simplicity parenting model, although he's into broader forms of simplifying too. Now, some of the stories you're going to hear from him about working the action shift at a group home for challenged youth, the night terrors of children in refugee camps in Southeast Asia after the Vietnam War, the look in the eyes of teenage gang members in the UK. It all leads into what Kim says is an undeclared war on childhood and the steps we can take to help our kids and ourselves reclaim the tools of health. Simplifying, the gift of creativity through boredom, and the evolving role of guardians as a child ages. In the end, this is a hopeful and empowering look into what we can do as individuals and as a culture to help the kids around us be calmer, happier, do better socially and emotionally, be more focused at school, and find it easier to appreciate family rules. Even if you don't have kids of your own, we all influence the young among us, and that's why I believe this episode applies to everyone. Here we go. Welcome, Smart and Simple Matters listener. I am excited right now, but not in my normal bundle of uncontained energy kind of way. I really think that's due to a calming influence of my guest today, Kim John Payne, who generally takes a rather measured but experienced approach to the world of simple. He's the co-author of the number one best-selling book, Simplicity Parenting, a consultant and trainer to over 200 North American independent and public schools, and can be found around the world giving a keynote talk here and a workshop there. He's been a school counselor, educator, researcher, and a private family counselor for 27 years, with the common thread that ties it all together: helping youngsters and families explore issues like challenging siblings, behavioral problems at home or school, and emotional issues like defiance, aggression, and addiction. One last thing, Kim lives in Northampton, Massachusetts with his wife and two kids, and I guess the only thing left to say right now is welcome to the show, Kim.
Nice to be speaking with you, Joel. Nice to hear your obituary before you die, isn't it, really? Thank you for that introduction.
I think I was born cheery, and it's just permanently there. Every once in a while, I get a little down. I don't think I've ever reached despondent. There's just so much to be grateful for and happy about in life. So it's kind of hard not to have a smile. Most days, at least. Well, let's start where I normally start an episode, which is with something I call the seeds of awesomeness, so that people can understand who you are now a bit better and why you've come to be the person that you are. Could you tell us one or two experiences that you had as a child, or maybe even something about your environment growing up that helps us figure out why you're the person you are right now?
Yeah, I guess there's two main things, actually. One is, you know, I grew up in the mountains in Australia, and I grew up amongst a group of just really great men, you know, men who looked after each other, who worked together, worked very, very hard up in the mountains, and a very sort of basic stuff. And I came to sort of recognize what it is that people can do when they come together. The house that I grew up in was a sort of a, you wouldn't call it a barn raising. That's exactly what happened. The men in the town would all come together and help build their own places. And I saw how just simply wonderful that could be, and how when there were those kind of gatherings, just how joyful life could be, and how very, very little was needed to have that joy in life. And so that was a backdrop, really, to my early years. And then moving forward, I was studying in psychology, and I always hasten to add, and I'm okay now, I'm perfectly fine. I was really struck in some classes I was taking at the time, because at the time I was living in a group home for what was then called violent and offending youth, and I was paying my way through college, living in this place, working through the night there. I worked the action shift, it was called, from 6 o'clock at night to 3 o'clock in the morning. It was called the action shift because it was. But at the time, during the day, I was attending lectures by a professor who was pioneering the whole field of what we now know as PTSD. And he was talking about war veterans, Second World War veterans, Korean, Vietnam War veterans. And as he was running through the symptoms of being over-controlling, hyper-vigilant, fight or flight, night terrors, all the classic symptoms of what we now know much more about, I was thinking about the kids in my group home, because they were over-controlling, hyper-vigilant, nervous, jumpy. And I went and asked him, I said, you know, you're talking about combat veterans who aren't doing so well, but I'm seeing that in my kids. Is that possible? And he gave me an answer that was interesting. He said, well, it's not impossible, but there's no empirical data. Now, there's an academic answer for you. And when my time was up in this group home, I had a very formative time where I traveled and volunteered in Southeast Asia at the time, at the end of the Vietnam War. And there again, I saw in the camps that I worked in Jakarta, and particularly in the Thai Cambodian refugee camps, there again, I saw nervous, jumpy, hypervigilant kids. I saw all the hallmarks of over-controlling behavior and what, you know, all the discipline problems and social problems that leads to. But again, it was a puzzle, you know, because here is a rather academic diagnosis of what then was called trauma response, and which was only meant to apply to combat veterans. Okay, so only combat veterans were meant to have this. But I, first of all, was seeing it in the kids in my group home, and that was a puzzle. And I couldn't quite figure it out, really, because it didn't meet the academic criteria. And then when I went to work in war zones, this was at the time, do you remember the whole time of the Khmer Rouge and the Pol Pot regime? And it was a terrible time.
I didn't live through it, but I certainly remember it from the history books.
Yeah, right. Well, that was the camps I was working in that were results of all that. And I could kind of get my mind around why these kids were so stressed, were so nervous, were so hypervigilant, were having such terrible, terrible night terrors at nighttime in the camps. Myself and a small team would walk around just dealing with just kids who were screaming and so scared. And we would sit with them and do our best to just be with them and assure them that we were there for them. But here again was classic PTSD. And yet they weren't combat veterans, but they were in a war zone. So then there's just one more step to this, you know, this simple little story, really deep and simple, is that when my time was up there, I decided to study this more, learn more about it. So I moved to the UK and I began postgrad studies. And there I set up an ordinary little counseling practice for west of London, just for ordinary kids, mixed ethnic, mixed racial, mixed economic, really just a regular counseling practice. And then through the doors came the same kind of kids. And you know what, Joel? It was a kind of a look in their eye. It was a way they moved. It was something I couldn't put my finger on, but it was really kind of disturbing because there I was seeing it again. There it was. Same kids, same, different kids, but same presentation. And it was too big a thought. I didn't want to let it in because I wanted to have a nice little kind of semi-rural counseling practice working with normal kids, sure. Right? I didn't want this. I wanted a little James Herriot type of counseling practice. And I wanted to study trauma, but I didn't want to deal with it at the time. But it wouldn't let me go. And I came to think of these kids as living in the undeclared war on childhood. There was something going on in these kids' lives from regular, I mean, of course they were rascals because they were coming to see a counselor, but something was going on that was so not okay that it just was, it was so striking that these kids looked like wartime kids. So I started digging into their biographies, listening, just simply listening to their stories, to what their day was like, what their week was like, and listening to the way in which they spoke.
Were you able to listen to them? I mean, the picture that you're painting here, especially working the action shift at this group home or in these camps in Southeast Asia, these Thai Cambodian camps that you're working in. I mean, these kids sound like, you mentioned a look in their eye, the way that they moved. I'm almost picturing in my mind some kind of shell-shocked, almost zombie just trudging through life until they just snap and lose control only to regain it back with the help or maybe physical or emotional with somebody like you. What can you describe a little bit what that is? I mean, when you say that you're listening to their stories, what kind of experiences, what thread could you trace beyond them in this undeclared war on childhood that you're talking about?
Yeah, it's an interesting way to put it. There's a thread. It's like this narrative thread that ran through these three biographical experiences for me. And that narrative thread was overwhelm. These kids were overwhelmed. The kids in the group home were largely gang members or kids coming from very abused backgrounds. So there was an overwhelm in their life. The kids in the refugee camps and the slums around Jakarta were in a different kind of overwhelm, but it was overwhelm. But the kids in the West, in the UK, in this, you know, where I first began to realize this, and now this has spread worldwide, but it's, they were dealing with overwhelm as well. It was just too much, too fast, too sexy, too young, too much. And what was happening as I then set a course for understanding more of this through the neural psychology and the neurobiology of it all, is that basically we've gotten about 900 to 1200 years ahead of ourselves in terms of the brain's ability to adapt to the stress hormones that an average kid has these days. We'll be fine. If we didn't have any more stress in our lives as families, we would probably adapt in about 900 years. That would be good in 900 years.
Where does that number come from, this 900 to 1200 years?
That comes right from research that a dear friend of mine, Dr. D. Joy Coulter, did for me. I actually asked her this. And she's in North Colorado State and in Naropa University. And she said, yeah, it's about, we've got about 9 to 1200 years given neurological ability to adapt. But she went on to say, even given that, there's a problem, because the amygdala, our fight or flight, freeze or flock brain, for the first time in human evolution, is actually reversing. And that part of the brain is that part of the trauma brain, the ability to really respond quickly and aggressively to situations. That's been shrinking as our second wrap, the creative brain, the limbic brain, and then the third wrap, which is the, you know, the frontal lobes, the executive, the let's get on together, let's really collaborate, let's work together. That brain, we've evolved, and those parts of the brain have literally grown, in size, but also in, of course, in activity. For the first time in human evolution, the ancient brain, the reptilian brain, the amygdala, is actually starting to grow again. And this also comes out of the book Transcendent Biology by Joseph Chilton Pierce as well. You'll find references to it there. So we are starting, because of the pace of life, this is not nothing. For the first time in human evolution, we're actually neurologically de-evolving. And as Joseph said in a talk that I attended of his, Joseph Chilton Pierce, is that the amount of fast, I call them fast hormones, the ability to be able to navigate the fast life. So the fast hormones that are pumping through our body, we become almost like adrenaline and cortisol junkies. And what Joseph was talking about is that actually that release of that much stress hormones in our body is unparalleled in human evolution. The only time that happens in a human body are when our species is under attack, is when our village is under attack, and we have to move fast and respond fast. But what's happened is that kind of lifestyle has become the new normal. That kind of lifestyle in the workplace, in homes, in schools, with the No Child Left Intact Act, it's become the new normal. It's become so ubiquitous that we've stopped noticing it. And that's what I started to see in these kids I was talking about. And now I'm starting very, very much to see this on a worldwide scale, that the new normal of the fever-pitched life, both at work, at home, at school, has become so normal that we're losing our ability to play together, to create together, to work together in a very creative way, but also to have that executive function of our brain, the frontal lobes, really be able to organize, inwardly still and calm ourselves. Because the amygdala is twice as fast. The amygdala operates in about 1/12 of a second. the frontal lobe takes twice as long. So it's what Daniel Goleman, the author of Emotional Intelligence and Working with Emotional Intelligence, a book that I particularly love, Working with Emotional Intelligence, it's what he calls amygdala hijack. But again, the problem is for so many folk, it's become the new normal. It's become what your neighbors do. You know, it's what, you know, the overwhelm of family life with just too many activities, just too much stuff. It's become so ubiquitous that it really takes a real act of consciousness to say, hang on a minute.
Yeah, we're like a fish in the water where the water, it's there. It's invisible to you. You swim through it. You don't notice it. That's just the way that it is. So when we surround ourselves with family, with a culture, that's just the way that it is, we forget where we've come from. I almost want to get a history lesson from you, Kim. I mean, some of the stuff that you're revealing and almost tracing this back to, when did this sense of overwhelm start? Maybe we'll save that for another time. This picture that you're painting, though, is quite dire. And I know, you know, we're both hopeful people. We're both optimistic people. And we've seen a lot of good. Mm. We've seen people wake up, recover from some of the issues that they've had growing up or that they still have. I guess part of that comes in, and we've been talking about kids so far. I know you are much more than that, and hopefully we get an opportunity to talk about that. But your solution, you were just briefly touching on it, those calmer and happier kids, more creative, more collaborative in nature. This kind of gets to the heart of what you call simplicity parenting. And maybe can you just, in terms of not a solution, this, it's not a cure-all for anything, but paint the picture for us in broad strokes. Why would kids, whether they're in Jakarta or London or in Minneapolis, why would kids in our modern, overwhelming, overstimulated environment really appreciate, separate from the parents, just the kids themselves, why would a kid enjoy that simplicity parenting model?
Well, one of the things that happens for kids, if given time, you know, like, you know, when we pick our kids up from school, I've got two teenagers, Joel, you've got two younger kids, you know, but you pick your kids up from school and it's almost like they are on a kind of a hyperdrive. They want to do this and they want to do that and they're talking about this and they want to go there and they want, and it's hard just to give our kids the gift of boredom, just to take them home and let them be bored, royally bored, because boredom is the precursor to creativity. Just like frustration, Freud talked about frustration being the precursor to learning. But what I think is, and I don't include myself with that hallowed company of Freud, but what I think is that boredom is the precursor to creativity. And when we let our kids have downtime, decompression time, which is a little bit boring, if we can kind of stick with it for about 20 to 25 minutes of time, this is not a random number I'm throwing out, 20, 25 minutes. By the way, if you've got a couple of kids, separate them for the first minutes. Okay. They take the boredom out on each other.
Don't let them come to the door and immediately wrestle with each other.
Yeah, you've got to be careful. Sometimes that can work. And also resist screen temptation, to actually stick them in front of a screen so that you can get on with what you're doing, which is usually screen-based. One of the amazing things that comes from boredom is this deep sense of creativity, this just simple, deep sense of creativity. And what's so interesting about this is that, you know, the movement to balance kids' lives is not just sort of simplifying on its own. It's actually just giving them a genuine balance. We all know that we need a balance between exercise and eating. We all know we need a balance in our waking life and sleep life. We've got to get enough sleep. Mm-hmm. But we also need a balance in terms of sensory input, in terms of our whole nervous system needs to ramp up. That's a good thing. It's a great thing, but it also needs a time to ramp down. And there's a sympathetic and the parasympathetic nervous system. They need to ramp up, it needs to ramp down. Otherwise, bad things happen in terms of our mental health, but our physical health. And when our kids go when they're let to be bored. What they do is so interesting, because we've got a lot of feedback now over the years, because we have approaching, I think there's about 700, and by the end of the next year or so, we'll have about 1,000 simplicity parenting coaches in the world, in every continent, in all manner of countries and communities around the world. All this fleet of simplicity parenting coaches who get a lot of feedback from the people they're working with. This isn't just centered around me and a small team. This is a big, big movement.
Absolutely.
And the feedback we get is so interesting, because when kids are given the chance to simplify, balance, have downtime, they start to play together better. When they have fewer toys, when there's just less in the environment, at the physical environment, I speak about that a lot in the Simplicity Parenting book, but also when there's less scheduling, when there's less conversation, just less. When the power of less enters their lives, what happens is they start to collaborate. And people have said, this is so weird. We've got rid of all these books. We've got rid of all these toys, all these clothes. We've pulled back all this scheduling stuff. And yet our kids are getting on so much better with each other. They're easier to discipline. You know, they're easier to guide. It just, everything's got easier. This is so weird. Why is this happening? Because you'd think, for example, with less toys, they're going to fight over the scarcity, right? So you fight over them. Well, the actual answer in the brain science is really simple, is that when kids have less and they're in nature more, they move out into the natural world, they've got more enticement. When the screen goes off, kids watch them, and I do. When their eyes leave the screen, when we can, you know, give ourselves the courage to turn off the computer, the TV, all the different screens, their eyes go from the screen to the window, and they start looking outside. It's amazing. It's that simple.
We are their eyes go from this, as humans. We
That's
are
right.
outdoor creatures. I know we spend most of our lives inside, but most of our wiring looks outside, and we yearn for that. We long for that. I'm talking inside right now. I'm looking out the window right now, Kim. I wish I was having this conversation with you on my deck. It's a wonderful day,
yep.
And I long to spend more time outside. Children, it doesn't matter what your age is. I think that's just a very primal, very human thing to do. And one of the things that I'm noticing here is, at no point have you mentioned the parents here. You as a parent are just creating an environment for your children to be bored, to be curious, and to explore. Kind of almost like out of sight. And that's one of the concepts that I've stumbled across when I was thinking about having a chat with you, this out of sight library, which maybe you can touch on really quick. And then also out of sight kids, not having the parental influence or the media influence on them all the time, just letting the kids either hang with each other or just immerse themselves outside, whether that's in the backyard, or maybe that's down the street, or maybe that's in the woods next door. What's the role of toys or books being out of sight, or your kids being out of sight, and the health of those kids themselves?
You know, one of the comments we get from so many parents is that when they start to dial all that stuff back and balance and simplify it, one of the things that starts happening is that the connection with their kids deepens. So they don't have stuff filtering it. They don't have scheduling, sports clubs, just overwhelm of sports clubs, of play dates, of toys, of books, of screens. All that is getting between us and a deeper relationship with our kids. So in terms of the overwhelming feedback from just now, we're talking about tens of thousands of parents, is how they remark that two things happen. One is that the kids start getting on better together, and the second point is that they start getting on better together with their kids. And it's not that problems don't come up. It's that when they come up, the kids are nervous, jumpy, hypervigilant. We're kind of back to that, right? Because that if when kids have got a problem, if they're in a state of overwhelm, they either have got two options. I cover this in my new book, Soul of Discipline, is they either, if they're extroverted kids, they'll push back against us. And if they're introverted kids, they'll fall back and become sullen and stubborn and not want us, you know, to let us into their lives so well, and be the pushback and fallback is not misbehavior. And I mentioned this in the book. I simply don't believe in disobedience. I've never met a disobedient kid. And I'm a counselor, right? I'm a therapist. Mm-hmm. I've met a lot of rascals, that's for sure. But then I don't believe in disobedience. I simply do not. I've never met a disobedient kid. What I've met is disoriented kids. And they're disoriented because of the overwhelm that's coming into their lives. They are not wired. They can't cope with it. Social and emotionally, they can't cope with it. And they push back or they fall back and everything gets hard. But when we simplify and balance things out, they don't have to be in survival mode anymore. They don't have to be in their amygdala and survival brain. They can be in collaborative brain. They can be in creative brain. And here's the really amazing piece here is that just over 38% of all jobs in the United States right now are for millennials, parents, and just adults under the age of 35 are freelance. 38% is freelance. We've got millions and millions and millions of young adults who are putting together their employment world. They do a little bit of this and a bit of that, and they collaborate with this group to get that done, and then they go to that contract and then that project, and it's very project-based, it's very creative. I think of it as tapestry employment. It's like a collage employment, and they put it together. Now, the piece that is so hopeful about simplicity parenting and about balancing kids' lives is that when we simplify, when we balance, and we give our kids time to be creative, innovative, and adaptable, that's all done through play. That's all done through getting together and figuring things out and kids having arguments and sorting it out and just being given time. Given time to actually develop those social and emotional skills. The thrilling thing for me is that how many of these kids, because the simplicity parenting movement is not a new movement, it's been going for decades now, it's just picked up pace in terms of size very rapidly over the last 10 years. But how many of these kids are doing so super well? Because the simplicity parenting movement, it's not this retrograde thing of Little House on the Prairie and wishing things to go back in time. And just like modern permaculture and biodynamics, it's not a wish to go back in time. It's a way of addressing world food needs. Well, the same with parenting is that this is when our kids learn to be, we give them time to be creative and innovative and adaptable. And that's an inner quality. It's not an outer thing. I know screens are creative, TV, computer games, they're creative. But we forget, Joel, that it's someone else's creativity. Mm-hmm. And we're just passively receiving it. It's not intrinsic, that's extrinsic. But when we give our kids time to be self-creating, not passive absorbers and consumers of other people's creativity, we're actually giving them a chance to be very successful in a world where those three qualities of creativity, of innovativeness, and being able to adapt, being able to shift, change, and adapt to it is what the new employment world is all about. I did the math on this, and if you've got a child who's 12 years old, by the time they're 22 years old, more than 50% of all the employment in the United States will be self-employed and freelance.
I believe it. I am self-employed, and I do some freelance work as well. I'm not exactly millennial, but having the resiliency, having the ability to self-organize, to self-motivate, these are things that are critical to my ability to not just make things happen, but to make the kind of impact in the world that I want and to play well with others. Whether you're a kid or whether you're an adult, the ability to mm-hmm. collaborate, the ability to create, co-create with people, that's one of the things that I love doing the most is individual pursuits. You know, I wrote a book. That was all well and good, but I don't, unlike you, Kim, you write wonderful books, by the way. I don't plan to do it again because it was a very solitary, isolating thing. I want to co-create with people now, and I also want to raise children. Maybe they want to write a book someday. That's great. Grant Clark, by all means, knock yourself out. But just the ability to, one, value the engagement with other people as opposed to retreating into a glowing screen and immersing yourself into a virtual world. That has its place as well. Like you, I mean, the environment that you're trying to create, well, I guess what I'm really trying to draw out here is giving your kids time, as you mentioned, but even more so than that, as a parent, this is one of the challenging things, but also one of the things that I feel is so empowering. I have the ability to get out of my kids' way and let them be children. Some of the things that we've missed out on. So that means not scheduling everything for them, letting them wake up on a Saturday morning and not have any kind of itinerary. Just, hey, let's exist. Let's be. Let's go outside. Or you go outside by yourself and go have fun. Come back when you're done. I think that that threshold in terms of just letting our kids be by themselves or creating that kind of loose structure where we can still make sure that they're safe. We can still make sure that their basic needs are met, but they also have the capacity for meeting a number of their needs, the emotional needs, the mental needs beyond the physical needs that they have. That's something that's really empowering to me, where I can see a lot of the promise of that. I want to ask you real quick, though. You mentioned The Soul of Discipline, your new book, and one of the facets of that, which I found fascinating, is our role as a parent and how that evolves. You talk about the governor, the gardener, and the guide, and how, so up through about 8 years old, viewing myself as the governor for my children. And then I become a gardener during their tween years and finally a guide through the teenage years. Can you just explain that real quick to us, how you came to this concept of the evolving role of a parent over the course of your kid's childhood?
Yeah, it's really got to do with calibrating what children need in terms of guidance and moving with them over the years. A lot of parents I've noticed. I'm a family counselor, and I've just noticed a lot of problems come up when a kid will sort of shout at the age of 12 or 13, "Don't treat me like a baby," you know, like they're just done. They're done with that way of being raised, and they're shouting out. But again, then they're not being disobedient or whatever. They're really trying to tell us something. And I just watched this for many years, and wherever a parent was able to shift the boundaries as their kids were able to inhabit the land, so to speak, you know, using that metaphor, it's just crucial that our kids, when they're little, have loving limits. But those loving limits, those boundaries, come out of that sense of governance, come out of that sense of, you know what, sweetheart, you're safe in this world. You're safe in this environment. Your mama, your daddy, you know, are really taking care of you. You don't have to worry about it. It's all good. It's all good. You just grow, and I might add, myelinate your brain.
But did you say myelinate your brain?
Myelinate your brain. In other words,
you're talking about myelin, the substance within the brain. Yeah. Okay.
Right. Yeah. Set yourself up for, you know, really, really healthy brain development. I can't help but add that, you know, therapists always have the weirdest kids because they're always thinking things like that.
Oh, I don't know. Not that we're having a competition here, Kim, but I know some non-therapists or non-psychologist children who are funky, but that's actually great too. And maybe that's part of it too, is we expect conformity. We expect social norms to be enforced and reinforced over and over again. And sometimes the social norms aren't very healthy for our children. So when we do have these funky children, we do have these unconventional kids, that's not necessarily bad. It's just not what we're used to. It's not mainstream. And maybe we should allow our kids to be that unconventional way.
Yeah. The thing that I've found is that we've got with a little kid up to the age of 7 or 8 years old, all they're basically wanting is to have a safe base, is to have family, parents, just to have a place that they can go out, explore the world, return, feel safe. And again, just social emotional ability, neurological ability is that they don't really have the ability to make really big choices, these big open-ended choices. It's one of the biggest, in my opinion, biggest mistakes we make is give our little kids way too many open-ended choices because they don't have the frontal lobe, the executive brain, the brain that can think ahead. They don't have the neurological ability to understand wider ramifications of cause and effect. They just don't. And we want them to understand all their cause and effect. We want them to consider their brother and sister and all this sort of stuff. And they're just not wired for that when they're little. And so in a sense, when we give our kids limited choices, when we say to them, you know, I call these you may choices. And the you may choices are you may choose between those three cereals on the counter. And any one of those three cereals will be fine by me. See, that's the governor. The governor is saying you may choose between those. And then the child chooses one and they feel good about it because they feel good. They get a little choice, mm-hmm. but they also feel good that they're being held within the family understanding. And it doesn't result in this weird sort of thing that goes on in so many kids' lives where they choose, like we say, okay, you can choose between the granola, the flakes, or the Cocoa Pops that your naughty uncle somehow left last week. Right.
We just got some
cocoa.
We just got some Gorilla Puffs from Trader Joe's, which are basically
non-cocoa
version of Cocoa Puffs. I remember those as a kid, and I will take responsibility for that one.
There you go, or the naughty daddy, the moment of just say what? Oh, come on, let's just loosen up here. Of course, but we put those on the counter, and then the kid goes right for the Cocoa Pops, and then we pause and we say to them now. With that, a poor choice, a good choice, or the best choice was. I heard one parent say once to a 4-year-old, was that suboptimal, optimal, or supraoptimal?
Oh,
and it's like the kid just will always say poor choice because they'll do it because they know that's the fast track to get away from this totally weird person that's asking them to make this judgment when the judgment brain, the orbitocortex, the frontal cortex, and the brain, it's just the judgment brain's not there, and we're spinning our kids out and making them feel so many discipline problems. Dramatically improve when we don't spin our kids out and make them feel unsafe and go into pushback or fallback by giving them too many choices too young. Yeah, they can have little you may choices. And as a kid grows into their tween years, I got a 13-year-old daughter right now, just about to step out of her tween years. And that's the gardener years. That's the years where I'm saying to my kids, to my daughter right now, she hears it a lot, is tell me your plans, sweetheart. What's on your mind, honey? Tell me how you see it. And I'm listening. I'm really listening. Like a good gardener listens to the soil, watches the sky, listens to the plants, will trim any invasive species if needed, but deals, what's going on here? Listens. But then when it's time to harvest, a gardener harvests, you know, I grew up on a farm, Joel. I mean, my grandfather wouldn't gather us together and, you know, when it was absolutely time to get the crops in and say, now who would like to share? It was like, we're doing this now. I've made this decision. Let's go. So a teenager, a kid from about the age of 10, 11, 12, 13, they need us to be a big heart with ears initially. Just listen in.
A big heart with ears. I like that image.
Yeah. Just listen in to what's on their hearts and how that affects our hearts. And that's all good. And so we listen in, and then we give them the security to know that then we'll make the decision really, really genuinely based on what it is they were telling us, but we're not expecting them to make a decision. Mm-hmm. And that's very, very securing on one hand, but at the same time honoring the fact that they're growing up and they're changing and they see the world differently. That's the gardener. And then that guide that you mentioned is more, you know, at home right now, I've got a 16-year-old daughter, and she has her own ideas of what she wants to do in the world. She has, like, kids who are 16, they can be interested a little bit in parents' lives and so on, but they can be spectacularly disinterested in our opinions. I mean, they do real well at that.
I'm sure I'll find out.
The best conversations I've ever had with my daughter, I had one just yesterday when we went out for a walk and we stopped off at the cafe and we sat and talked for ages, was about her direction in life, about what she wants to do, what she, her emerging thoughts and ideas and where she wants to go. Now, a good guide is listening in to what, if you're a mountain guide, for mountaineering, you're listening in to where that person wants to go, how they want to go up that mountain, what route they're planning on taking, and so on and so on. And then, because you know the terrain better than them, you'll guide them. You'll say, okay, well, if you want to do that, here's the route. You want to avoid this and avoid that because that will really slow you down.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the best conversations I've ever had with teenagers when things go wrong is not about my opinions, because that's not of primary interest. What's interesting to a teenager is, was that a distraction? Did that take you off the path to your own summit, to your summiting your life? Did that take you off the path, or did that take you forward? And if it took you off the path, which I think it did, but do you think it did? You know, and talk to them about that. How do we get back on the path towards your goal, not towards you becoming who I think you should be? No, when a kid's 16, 17, they want to become who they want to be. And that's why there's that guide image. But that is not an image that we can apply to a five-year-old. And we get it back to front as a society. We tend to raise our little kids with way too many choices in this guidance principle about what they want to do and where they want to go and how can we help them and what do they... And then when they get to 14, 15, we try and put the genie back in the bottle because it's uncontrollable now. Kids just don't really have come into contact with our authority, with our loving authority, but our authority. And then we try and parent them like they're little, like in the governor principle. So we give them this guidance principle too young. And then when they're older, we try and haul it back in with a governor, you'll do what you're told type of thing. And it's very, very difficult. I'm suggesting we get them lined up in the right way.
Yeah, well, I can almost hear the parents of teenagers right now jotting down furiously, was that a distraction? Did that take you off the path? I mean, those are wonderful questions to ask anybody, but especially a teenager. I would imagine those are really powerful. Boy, we have a lot more ground that we could cover. Before we even started recording, we were talking about permaculture and slowing down and relationships with money, all topics that we didn't quite get into. I do, since we've hit the soul of discipline and simplicity parenting so hard and just kind of sticking with that, I do want to encourage people to go to your simplicityparenting.com website, because you have, you've told us some wonderful stories and experiences, but you're also looking for people's stories.
Totally.
There are a number of questions which are great. How have your efforts to simplify your life been thwarted by family, friends, societal pressures, or overexposure to media outside of your home? How are you able to emotionally disengage when your child is pushing all your buttons and remain calm but effective? I would encourage people, you've helped us by this conversation, to go to your website and also submit a story, whether it's one of triumph, whether it's one of challenge, maybe it's one of the combination of two, whether it starts as a tragedy or something else, just a lot of resources there, but also your request for people's help as well. And telling stories, sharing those stories are wonderful too. Well, Kim, I want to make sure that you do have an opportunity. If there's something that we didn't talk about that you would like people to know, care to mention anything else?
You know, I think one of the perhaps just the last pieces on my mind is that simplifying and balancing our lives is not something that one is doing out of a, you know, more of a cognitive abstract place. It could be an interesting thought. But what I've noticed over the last 10 years or so is that more and more parents all around the world have got this feeling that something is wrong, that this is just not okay. What's being asked of us in our workplace, because I work in the corporate world as well, in the not-for-profit world with adults, the pace of and their expectations in the workplace, family life. This has just gotten out of control. And this feeling, this gut instinct is a wonderful, wonderful piece to listen to. And what I've been really interested in over the last 10 years is how many hundreds of thousands of people around the world have actually started listening to their gut instinct, because our instincts, they will help us when we look around the new normal of the supersized lifestyle and of what I call peak stress. We've got to peak oil, we know about that, but we've also got to peak stress. Our bodies cannot continue to cope with this without serious mental and physical health issues. We are at peak stress. And we're maxed out. We've maxed out our nervous systems to the point where there's all kinds of cost to that. And we're starting to really understand about peak stress as it exists in various walks of our life. And it's one of the ways, the instinctual side of things, is one of the ways in which we can regroup and rebalance. And it's a very, very interesting thing that, for example, the Simplicity Parenting Movement has given birth to so many hundreds of thousands of people who have found a way to not so much, you know, listen to some parenting expert, because I don't know, parenting, anyone who claims they're a perfect parent should come like with a health warning, like on cigarette packages or something.
You know, I don't think a perfect parent really, has ever existed.
Yeah, that's
a dangerous claim.
Yeah, really. But it's, listening to, one of the mother said to me quite often, you know, Simplicity Parenting is such a weird book because it doesn't try and teach you a single thing. It doesn't tell you to do one single thing. It just suggests you do less and just builds a pathway of stories, basically, of examples of how less has been so powerful. But the end result of this, and the thing that so many people discover is, it's almost a cliche to say it, but they find their own inner voice rather than what they're told, what their parent-in-laws tell them to do, what their boss tells them to do, what the society or the marketers, particularly the marketing forces, tell them that you've got to have. When one simplifies, we'll do anything for our kids, anything. I mean, honestly, it's so beautiful, so precious. We'll do anything. And when we simplify and balance for our kids, and we realize how it's almost like we get our little kids back. We get them back again. You know, every child is born with what Aristotle called telos, you know, a telos, with what he called a spirit-imbued purpose. One of my daughters was born. Yeah, there weren't any golden harps playing. She was born rolling up her sleeves, looking me in the eye, saying, "Hold on to your chakras, Dad, because here we go. Can you cope with me? Can you cope with me?" I was waiting for the harps, you know, like, where are the harps? Please, the harps now. And no. And it's like they're born with this intent. And if we can get out their way, within, you know, establish the boundaries for their lives and then get out their way while they explore that terrain. And when they grow up a little bit more, expand the boundaries and then get out the way again. What happens is that they discover that life purpose. And it's a beautiful thing to see happening all over the world. But what it does is that it gives a kind of... It lets us listen to our instinct about this so that we can let our kids be who they've come to be.
Wow. Wow. Powerful stuff. That was, of course, the tip of the proverbial iceberg, because you have so much more to say. You have interviews and books and so much research and so much experience. And if people want to get more into Simplicity Parenting, or maybe they want to hear your views on other concepts related to the grand world of simplicity, which is much bigger than just parenting, where else can they go online in order to find you or find your work?
Well, you know, we are proudly a part of a lot of parenting groups and movements, and so in a sense, ours is like a doorway into a wider world of parents who are collaborating and working together all around the world in various parent organizations, and that's at simplicityparenting.com. And we have all kinds, anything from just simple little 1 or 2 minute videos to linking up with other parents to things that I put out. Everything from that. Recently, we just put out around discipline, we put out 7 questions that I'm most commonly asked by parents and 7 questions I wish I was asked. And that's just a free little video series. It's there. And then soon there's people who want a deeper dive. There's a whole home practice guide around simplicity and particularly around simplicity and discipline. And a whole home practice guide is happening within the next 3 or 4 weeks. So there's all kinds of linkages at that Simplicity Parenting website.
Sounds like that's the hub, and people can explore from there. Well,
yeah.
Kim, I'm grateful for your time, for your stories, both the hilarious ones and the frankly somewhat shocking ones, especially you're talking about in your youth and growing up and seeing these children. Me and a lot of other people, we have a lot of work to do in terms of restoring not just the innocence, but restoring our culture, the environment in which our kids grow up on. Hopefully you will make an assessment that we are giving up the undeclared war on childhood. And I can see some strides being made, and I'm glad that you're out there helping us all make them. So thank you again.
Totally. Thank you, Joel. And you know, what we're doing essentially is just in the undeclared war on childhood, we're declaring peace in our homes.
And yeah, wow. Okay, let's leave it there, because I cannot possibly do something that's going to complement that comment. Thank you again, Kim.
Thanks, Joel. Bye-bye for now.
Oh my gunny sacks. Was that deep or what? You know, I almost feel like I missed an opportunity, though, to expand the conversation beyond Kim's typical topics of simplifying parenting and childhood, but I feel really good about the wisdom he shared with us. Now, how about you? Did we maybe skirt a topic you were hoping we'd cover? Maybe you want me to bring him back on the show for a round deuce? Do you want to see those questions that he's hoping you'll answer on his simplicityparenting.com website? Leave a comment in the show notes about it, or find links to go deeper into Kim's world at valueofsimple.com/SASM079. That's valueofsimple.com/SASM079. Tell you what, I would love to have Kim do a workshop at our Simple Rev 2015 event, but it's a bit too tight to coordinate something like that. 2016, perhaps? Let's nod our heads on that one. One thing I do know is that it's not too late for you to participate in Simple Rev 2015 on October 2nd and 3rd in Minneapolis, Minnesota. You can snag your ticket, fill up on some gratitude, get hands-on in some amazing workshops, and find your simple living friends, old and new, when you go to simplerev.com/tickets. They're not going to be out there for too much longer. It's late July 2015, so I hope to give you a hug in a couple of months in Minneapolis and open the doors to an intentional world of abundance and probably a side of funkiness. Now, whether this was your first run through a Smart and Simple Matters episode or you're a long-time listener, I'm grateful for your time and attention. I'm always grateful for what you give me and what I love to give right back to you. Let's do this again soon, yeah? Yeah, let's do it. It's now time for your partner in simplifying to sign off again. You've just listened to the Smart and Simple Matters podcast with Joel Zaslavsky, creator of All Things Value of Simple.